Last autumn, I spent a week with my children and my parents in Malta, staying at a hotel in St. Paul's Bay. And St. Paul's Bay is so called because it's reputed to be the location that St. Paul, the Paul of the Bible, came to Malta having been shipwrecked offshore. He was on one of his many journeys around the known world at the time, the Mediterranean, telling people about Jesus Christ, about his life, his death, and his resurrection. St. Paul is the most prolific contributor to the New Testament. We've already learnt, if you've been here in previous weeks in our series through the Bible, how his life was turned upside down. He went from being a God-hater, a hater of the Christians. He had an encounter with the Holy Spirit, and then he became one of the most passionate evangelists and church planters history has ever known through that encounter with God. So he was a church planter, really. That was his heart. He set up small communities of Christians wherever he went, wherever there was a warm response to the words about God, all the way around the eastern part of the Mediterranean. But he also had itchy feet. He didn't hang around anywhere particularly long. He was always on to the next thing, the next place. So much of what we learn about St. Paul is vicariously, indirectly, through letters that he wrote. And you know, if you wrote a letter, does anybody write letters anymore? Occasionally, you might write a letter nowadays instead of an email. But to write, if you read letters, and you might read letters from other people sometimes, perhaps you read through letters of parents or others whose belongings you're looking through. And you read the letter with interest, don't you? But you only have half the picture with a letter, because you need to know a little bit about the people to whom it was written as well to get the full picture. So who was Paul writing to in Galatia? Well, he was writing to a small group of Christians who had done quite a few things well in their Christian community life together, but also were getting some things wrong. And this letter, like many of Paul's letters, was a mixture, therefore, of encouragement on the one hand and challenge or correction on the other. Now, he doesn't pull his punches. If you just keep your finger in chapter 5 and go back to chapter 1, verse 6, he begins, "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you to live in the grace of Christ and turning to a different gospel, the one I didn't preach to you." He doesn't pull his punches. So what had been going wrong since he'd been with them? Well, Paul had taught them the truth of the gospel, which is this, that Jesus came to show us what God is like, to be an example for us, but supremely to die on a cross in our place, so that we could be forgiven and not punished and be friends with God. He preached that that was free. It didn't cost you anything to be forgiven. Now, since then, the Galatians and Christian communities ever since Galatian time as well have at times got it wrong, because they, like the Galatians, have drifted back into thinking and believing and acting that the only way you can be right with God is by doing things. You have to earn forgiveness. That's the mistake that the Galatians, or the error in their thinking, they'd slip back. They were, of course, from a Jewish background, many of them. And they had the whole of the Old Testament, which was based upon a set of rules. Do this and you'll be right with God. And they'd slip back into that way of thinking. No, says Paul. Chapter 2, verse 19, he says, "I do not set aside the grace of God." The grace of God is God's free gift of love. "Because if righteousness could be gained by the law, Christ died for nothing." He doesn't pull his punches, does he? He says, Christ's death on the cross is nothing. It means nothing if you're going to go back to believing that you have to earn your place in God's favour by doing things. You Galatians have got it wrong. And in chapter 5, verse 1, he goes on to say, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then. Don't let yourself be burdened again by a yoke of slavery." This is the implication of going back to that old way of thinking. It's not freedom at all. Living by a set of rules, trying to please God day in, day out by doing the right thing, becomes a yoke of slavery. Have you ever tried to do that? Have you ever been in a place in your life when you thought that you had to please God by doing the right thing? I know that was the case for me when I was at university. For some reason, and I guess it probably was God, in his graciousness and wisdom, I was away for a whole summer and I decided I would read the Bible. And so I was quite a formable, sort of convicted type at the time, and I decided I'd try and read the Bible every day. So I did. It was absolute torture. It did nothing for me. But because I decided I was going to read the Bible every day, I read the Bible every day. But God really, I don't know what was going on. Anyway, eventually, I think something, I had a bit of an experience, not quite like St. Paul, but everything fell into place. And then, and since then, I'm not saying I read the Bible every day because some days I miss that, but whenever I do read the Bible, there's something very, very different about the experience. It's life-giving. I'm not doing it to try and earn God's favour. I'm doing it because I want to do it. There is nothing that you and I can do to make God love us any more than he does already, or any more than he did when we were in our mother's womb. So that's the correction of thinking that Paul makes in the first four chapters. The Galatians have had it double barrel. But he's not finished yet. He's not finished yet. He turns his attention now to another mistake, almost to correct the alternative mistake that people make and that Christians have also made over the centuries. So one mistake people have made is to say and believe and act that actually you have to earn God's favour by doing the right thing. The other mistake people have made is that they've read all of it. They've read the Bible. They've read what it says about us being free, salvation being free, forgiveness being free. And they've then said, well, actually, then it doesn't matter how I live. What I do doesn't matter because I'll be forgiven for it anyway. And that's also a mistake. Paul says to that mistake, chapter 5, verse 13, if you were called to be free, you were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. Love your neighbor as yourself. Of course, there is, therefore, a place for rules in the Christian life, for standards, not to earn God's favour, but as a response to his love. The best relationships are based on love, aren't they? And out of that love flows a sense of duty, a sense of care, a sense of comfort and honour of one another. You're not doing it to earn somebody's favour. That would be the worst kind of relationship. No, you're doing it because there is love and you respond in that way. So yesterday, and we had two weddings yesterday here in Dedham and in Ardley. Question I ask, and Merv asked the couples, will you love, honour, protect, comfort and strengthen one another? And be faithful to one another as long as you both shall live. And that conversation, really, those vows that are made between the couples are on a basis of love, not duty, but love. Take the example of lying. Gospel freedom says to us that if I lie, I will not be cut off from God. So has anybody ever lied? Oh, only about half the people here. Okay, fair enough. Right. Well, those of us who have, you're okay. You will not be cut off from God. Okay, hear that truthfully. There are some people who try so hard to live their lives without lying because they believe that they have to prove themselves to God that when they do, and everybody does, they're devastated. That's morality motivated by fear. And I don't know about you, it sounds a bit like a yoke of slavery to me, not freedom. But I'm not letting you off the hook, just in case you think you can go out of here and just lie to your heart's content. Why would I even ever want to lie? Why? Why do we lie? Just turn to the person next to you for a moment and ask them, why do you lie? Why have you ever lied? What motivates you to lie? Sorry, only the people who do lie. You know, the rest of you can sit there and obviously. So why do we lie? This is the interactive bit in the sermon. Okay. And there may be a decision made, a judgment about that, yes. Fear, what are you afraid of? Right, okay. So you might not tell someone the truth about something that they've done because you might upset them. Even if they might. And they might respond to you in an unpleasant way. So it might be a protective mechanism for you, not only for them, but also for you. Okay, any other reasons why we might lie or bend the truth? Tell a white lie, even.
Get out of trouble.
Yeah. To get out of trouble, to preserve our reputation. So I'm sure we all like to be approved. We all like to feel that we're in power, that we are comforted, that we're successful. Those sorts of feelings are some of the things that drive us to lie or massage the truth, if you're more comfortable with that word or that phrase. But if you're totally loved by God, and if you know that deep, deep down inside, what's preventing you telling the truth? Why would you fear losing any of those things if you know ultimately that you're loved by God? I know because I've talked to many of you that you've had at times in your working lives had to stand up and not tell a lie, tell the truth, and it's had a consequence for you at work. You've lost business, you've lost money, you've lost reputation. But you've done the right thing. And I hope perhaps some of that might be because deep inside, you know it's A, the right thing to do, but B, God will love you throughout that experience. So why would I ever want to lie? Now, in normal religion, as I've said, the motivation for morality is fear. But in Christianity, the motivation is love. But of course, it does require effort. Love requires effort. Couples that stand here Saturday by Saturday say, in response to the question, will you love, honor, protect, comfort? They say, I will. They don't say, I do. They say, I will. It requires effort. Because there are two natures at work in every Christian, Paul says. The spirit on the one hand and the sinful nature on the other. If we live by one, we will not gratify the other. But if one is in ascendance, the other one will be diminished. Now, the sinful nature is sometimes described as flesh in parts of the Bible. But this doesn't refer to the fact, this isn't saying that our physical body is in battle with our spiritual body. That's not the sense in which it's saying. It's actually saying that the sin-desiring aspect of our whole person is battling against the God-desiring aspect. We all know that. That's true, isn't it? That is the life that we live. Paul says, the good I want to do, I don't do, and the bad I don't want to do, I do. In simple terms. We know that. That is our lived experience. It's an internal battle. It's a battle of the desire. That Paul uses the word desire in verses 17 and 18. The Greek word, epithumia, literally means over-desire. It's an all-controlling drive and longing. Now, the main problem with our heart is not so that we have desires for bad things, classic idea of sin being about eating too many cream cakes, but it's about having over-desires for good things. Not having too many desires for bad things, but having over-desire for too many good things. Because when a good thing becomes our God, it in itself creates over-desires. So let's have an example. For example, money. Money is neutral. And money can be very, very well used. It's a good thing, in fact, isn't it? But actually, if it becomes something that we purposely seek, it can become our God, and then it's all self-reinforcing, and that becomes our motivation in life. Sex is a good thing. God invented it. The same could be said about it. Paul says that our sinful desires become deep things that drive and control us. If the sinful nature in us has its desires, then so does the Spirit, according to Paul in verse 17. But what does the Spirit in us desire? It longs that Jesus is glorified. And this happens, brothers and sisters, in Dedham and Ardley, as you and me become more like Jesus. That's how Jesus is going to be glorified in our village. As more of us look more like Jesus, as we walk, talk, live out our lives, that's how Jesus is going to be glorified in our village. Living the way of the Spirit is, I suggest to you, what we all really deeply want inside. But there's this competing desire, which we can give into at times. But there is hope in the struggle. Even when we're falling into sin, we can say with Paul, this is not the real me. Say it to yourself. You've been crucified with Christ. You are a new creation. It's the devil who's saying, you've failed. You'll never be a good Christian. No, tell yourself, this is not the real me. I am a new creation. It's not what I really want. And if you now look at verses 19 to 21, you see this list of the acts of the sinful nature. They are a combination of actions and attitudes. Some are characteristics of the sorts of religious Pharisee-type people that Jesus encountered. So-called, perhaps, religious people. People who often fell prey to selfishness, to envy, and to jealousy. Others are more characteristic of what you might describe perhaps more as non-religious people, things like immorality and drunkenness. But it's fascinating that God puts them all together in one sentence. He doesn't make the kind of distinctions that we make, seeing, for example, sex and drink as more sinful than jealousy and ambition. He puts them all together. Of course, if you're anything like me, you're much better at noticing somebody else's sinful attitudes than your own. So it is worth thinking about which of these we see in our lives. But not just that, because that's probably pretty easy, but actually then doing a little bit more work to ask ourselves the question of what is the over-desire that is causing us to think or behave in this way? What's behind it? But let's finish on a positive note, shall we? Let's move from the acts of the sinful nature to the fruit of the Spirit. And the fruit takes us into the realm of growth. And we have a great visual image of this because we are, hopefully, if you have a garden or if you're outside at all at the moment, everything's coming back into life, isn't it? Everything is coming back into life because of the rain. In fact, growth is actually quite rapid. Mostly growth is fairly gradual, isn't it? Sally will be pleased to hear that the pumpkins that we planted in Rise and Shine back in March? May. Are actually doing quite well now. They were looking rather sad before I went on holiday, but they've been well watered. Gradually they're growing. Growth is gradual. It's gradual in you and me too, as Christians. But it is also inevitable. It's inevitable. Your grass is growing. You're going to have to mow the lawn soon. You can't get away from it. Between the showers, you're going to have to mow the lawn. Growth in Christians is also inevitable. It will happen. If the Spirit is in you, it will happen. And that's a real encouragement, I think. We're all becoming more like Jesus if we allow the Spirit to do. It's also internal. It's actually something that's going on inside, and that's the important thing. So yesterday I picked this apple from the tree in my garden. This apple has no life of its own. It's got to be eaten now fairly quickly or stored. Got its life from the tree. And the tree got its life from the sun and the water and the nutrients and so on. It's not the apple that gives life to the tree. The apple is a sign of life in the tree, isn't it? And these characteristics, the fruit of the Spirit, are characteristics of an internal life. They're not the life themselves. And finally, they are symmetrical, these characteristics. Do you notice how Paul describes this as the fruit of the Spirit? Sometimes we make the mistake of describing this as fruits. And often we'll have, and I don't knock it because it's often really good talks, but talks, all age talks, and we have lots of different balloons or things like that, and we all look at these fruit as different things. And we think, oh, I need to concentrate on that one today or on that one tomorrow. Actually, Paul says, no, fruit grows in a symmetrical way in a Christian. What do I mean by that? In other words, that all of these things, if the Spirit is in you, will be growing in you all the time. Some of these things are natural talents and part of our temperament. So, for example, somebody might be temperamentally quite a gentle person. So they look at this list and think, well, I'm pretty good at gentleness. But actually, it might not necessarily be the Spirit working in them. It's just temperamentally, they're quite gentle. And at the same time as being gentle, at the same time, maybe they're not very bold or they lack courage. And so when they're faced with having to do something that's a bit risky, well, no, they don't go for it. And that's actually not the Spirit. That's just natural temperament. No, the Spirit, you should see the Spirit in you working all of these things. Is that a bit tiring? Actually, I don't think you should be focusing on the things. You should be focusing simply on saying, God, grow me to become more like Jesus. I don't think you should be using this as a tick list to try and, you know, because that's back to more of the earlier stuff, isn't it? Earning your way. The Holy Spirit, if you ask him, will work in you. So live by the Spirit and keep in step with him. It's as simple as that. Amen.